Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. In a universe that seems to contain 2 trillion or more galaxies, that is expanding to God knows where, a quadrennial presidential election on a peewee marble of a planet on the fringe of a middling galaxy probably doesn't count for much in a cosmic sense. But it does mean quite a lot to the fraction of us puny human beings who are an aggregate of nearly 10 billion of our single species sprawled all over our little spinning ball like maggots on a peach. Most of you have most likely got your voting done. Oregon is the star of early voting, and await results, which will have to wait until Tuesday, November 8th, which happens to be my sister, Mary Antonina's birthday, as it was 28 years ago in 1988, when G.H.W. Bush Sr. was elected, and 1960, when she was 13, and the first Catholic president, JFK, was elected without the Pope, the great John the 23rd's assistance. Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his cousin Theodore were both elected on November 8th, 1932 and 1904, inversely, although Vice President Teddy took office in 1901 when William McKinley was assassinated. Abraham Lincoln was reelected on November 8th in 1864. Prior to 1845, the states elected presidents over a 34-day period before the first Wednesday in December, primarily because of the transportation encumbrances of the time, as well as the distances between towns and settlements. Oregon's vote by mail and early voting in other states is a sly return to the old standard. The next time a presidential election occurs on November 8th will be 2044. The bicentennial year of Clatsop County. So I must make the disclaimer that what I'm about to pontificate is my not entirely nonpartisan opinion, and perhaps only mine, in all the 2 trillion-plus galaxies. I call it Vote for Life and Liberty. Once again, the United States of America is in need of a revolution to thwart incipient tyranny and the blatant attempt by a few robber barons, whom the Constitution warned us against, from seizing control of the remnants of government that operates on the behalf of the people. This necessary revolution is underwritten in the nation's principles and is as sweeping in its implications as the original revolt against English rule, which was as corrupt, despotic, and hubristic as American governance is devolving into. This revolution is within the law. It is supported by the law, in design, if seldom in practice. And the law not only provides its mechanics, the law, in a very real sense, depends on it to maintain its integrity. This revolution is more binding than the ancient right to remove emperors in old China or revolt against kings and church in medieval Europe. This revolution is the vote, guaranteed after much struggle and constitutional amendments to all citizens, which too many abuse by disuse more than by voter suppression or gerrymandering. On average, less than 50% of eligible voters in the United States vote. Disgust and powerlessness, not apathy, alienate millions of citizens from the polls and are a major source of great public discontent that affects even those who do vote, who are discouraged and fed up. That discontent might be tapped by concentrating on registering to vote the many millions who have dropped out of the political process or have never been given much opportunity or incentive to participate in it. If these millions of ordinary people were to rise from their bitter cynicism and use nothing more than their constitutional right to vote, they will discover they have the power to transform much of what has gone off track in our recent history. It is time to recognize that the heart of our liberty is disappearing in the despair of the deprived and disenfranchised. Non-voters are generally economically impaired and suffer most from inequities and corruption, with little chance of prosperity in the existing status quo. Yet the potential of real power lies within these disaffected masses. All politics are local. While the trend seems to favor high-pressure political professionals funded by large amounts of money, which increasingly fragments the electorate with nasty advertising and PAC-backed candidates, they are vulnerable to the progressive populism of grassroots organizations and campaigning that must be organized at the community level in every community in the United States. We have allowed the vote to be trivialized and made much less than its true potency. Money has been substituted. The cash candidates accept supersedes the vote and ensures their continuance in power, which is treated as a commodity to be purchased. Securely established incumbents count on fewer people to vote to maintain power and on ever larger contributions from wealthy and corporate sponsors who use their money to turn campaigns into public ordeals of fear and loathing. Voter suppression is a particularly egregious strategy to disenfranchise minorities under the rubric of virtually non-existent voter fraud. Paradoxically, as almost direct cause and effect, fewer Americans voting cheapens the vote as well as makes it cheaper to purchase. Not voting is a virtual assurance those who do not vote will remain powerless as they become increasingly victimized. The next most necessary thing we must do is ensure that our votes count, which means demanding paper verification of our votes. The best way to do that is replace suspiciously tamper-prone high-tech voting machines with paper ballots, which is the method most world democracies continue to use because it is the most reliable. Paper ballots are counted by people, not by machines. There are no patent liabilities involved in the process of hand-counting votes, and the checks and balances and rechecks to ensure the accuracy and honesty of counting ballots are required by law. And ultimately, as it is with juries, the people who count ballots regard their task with grave responsibility. The Oregon Voter Rights Coalition, which was formed after the 2004 election in which 98% of the state's votes were tabulated on voting machines manufactured by the very corporations implicated in nationwide computer fraud, says it is necessary for every voter to be informed about the facts of voting machine use and the possibility of their corruptibility. Suggestions to reduce the possibility of fraud include the specific demand that corporations and politicians get out of counting the votes. Also, that open source election software be employed for transparency and the use of scientifically designed election verification processes. Methods of ensuring election integrity incorporate logic and accuracy tests, audits of precincts, countywide and/or statewide verification, and recounts of votes by hand counting all paper ballots for races that are in doubt. Other suggestions are that volunteer groups take up poll watching without intimidation or coercion, and that election returns be posted at the precinct level. Public display of results in precincts is essential because the audit trail gets lost once they are transmitted to centralized counting sites. Also, retain ballots in voting machines in which they are counted for later documentation. Most importantly, the Oregon Voter Rights Coalition exhorts voters to not let another election go unchallenged, as most of us might remember the infamous election of 2000, but not in the vile, threatening manner that Donald Trump claims is his prerogative. The current political climate in the United States is one of incendiary reversion, of savage descent to public ignorance and intolerance, which are generally present but not always given the respect or power of recent years. The rights and equities of common citizens are in peril. Serious, almost morbid attention is paid to the pathological pieties and prejudices of religious zealots, racial supremacists, and far-right ideologues who act at the extreme edge of our anxieties and reduce the national dialogue to a medieval level while manipulating the democratic process to ultimately eradicate it. America is always at war with itself. It is a battleground of disparity. Political equity and liberty have not been easy achievements, nor justice anything but a bloody war between those who would extend democracy and those who limit it. The United States is a democracy because it is a necessary contrast to despotic chaos. We have inherited a few basic rights and liberties sought by the mass of humanity for millennia, as well as a few limits on power to restrain the predatory ambitions of many among us. The hard-right military-industrial Tories are quite probably the people our ancestors warned us against and attempted to prevent their future usurpation of power with constitutional government and separation of powers, as well as with the Bill of Rights, which have been the secular Ten Commandments of our civilization for the past 225 years, this December 15th. We are a democracy, yet we know little about democracy. Sovereignty, independence, and equal rights do not come easily and never stay very long without constant feeding and nurturing. It took a long time to be convinced of the possibility of freedom, even though our predecessors inherited a powerful but thwarted tradition of rights and liberties. Yet the further removed we are from the intense imperatives of our ancestors for freedom and equality, the more we take for granted what they fought to establish, and the greater the danger we will allow them to be wrested or frittered away. Our own revolution was in fact the result of bitter disappointment the mother country did not recognize the loyalty to ancient principles its colonies in North America felt they had exhibited in resisting what they considered illegal and proscriptive edicts intolerable to honest and loyal subjects. The country is rapidly retrogressing from a diversely construed democracy centered on the rule of common folk to an aristocratocracy of private fortunes and multinational corporations, which the Supreme Court has defined as persons. The USA is at a crossroads as severe and consequential as the Civil War, a crisis that will define its future as a nation and society, either ruled by plutocratic councils of corporate CEOs and bankers, as in old Venice, or an open society as envisioned in its most fundamental beliefs and laws, participating as well as a leading member of a world confederacy of presumably eventual democracies. The real issue is the disparity of wealth, which complicates and corrupts every other issue. Essentially, a few white men of wealth are making an intolerable grab for power and ordination of a country club apartheid that has severely eroded the basic fiber of democracy. We do not have a political system that presents us with the best choices our country can offer. The insular filtration process of two political parties screens out nearly everybody qualified for public office, and is so ripe for constitutional infidelity that it extensively awards a gluttonous minority over the interests of the electorate. The nation's political and economic structure needs massive and real change to transfer power and wealth back to the majority of ordinary citizens who are the true leaders of democracy. Politicians who are supposed to represent the people are little more than political real estate for rent or lease. The plutocrats gorging on the upward flow of money due to tax breaks, entitlements, and low wages paid employees act like old Roman gentry. Elites take root in every society and wield disproportionate power unless a counterbalance restrains them. The two-party system fails this purpose. It is too exclusive and compressed, and it eliminates too many people and ideas from the actual process of governance and elections. The parties, in reality, serve politicians, not voters. Although there are many who fear that more political parties will open up the process too much and render it unstable and ultimately unmanageable, the nation is too large, too populous, too complex to be adequately represented by only two viable parties. The current system does not represent the incredible variety and tenor of American politics, as population and cultural diversity have multiplied immensely and has resulted instead in shrinking democracy. A new party is necessary to represent the unrepresented majority that does not possess equivalent wealth, property, or power, and also to reflect gender and racial equity. Several new parties. It is perhaps necessary that we have a functionally international party, or parties, if we are to have a global economy dominated by amalgamated mega-corporations, which are fundamentally interlocking commercial empires that command vast wealth, capacity, and political influence. Parochial politics are inadequate to defy the global power structures forming beyond the shores of the United States that are dominated and augmented by its economic and military power. Like it or not, humanity is the global civilization. Nuclear weapons rendered the nation-state as dead as dinosaurs. If the so-called global economy is manipulated to benefit only a few wealthy nations and mega-corporations, rather than be a world structure meant to include everybody in equal protections and freedoms, then the nightmare of 9/11 15 years ago is merely the advent of a dark future. A world government consisting of separate states will certainly be as fractious, messy, and malevolently divisive and maliciously class competitive as the United States has been since its inception. All of our national woes will be magnified and compounded, as will those of every other nation. But as the European Union struggles to find a common identity from its diverse identities, despite Brexit breakaways, so eventually will world civilization. In a world community, political parties, as well as labor unions, environmental and medical health organizations, must think and act globally. As an international party such as the Green Party, which is active in 80 countries, might offer a best opportunity for the initial globalization of political power, in particular for representation of the immense and rapidly expanding global underclass, because its origins and organizations are at the grassroots level. The paradox is that the United States simultaneously acts as international successor to Rome and the British Empire in world affairs, intruding incessantly into global political and economic matters, while rejecting global influence in its own internal affairs. If the U.S. intends to unilaterally dominate the world, the implications of our own Constitution underscore the rights of populations under our thumb to have a say, as well as a vote in our governance and global policies. Even Rome granted citizenship to non-Roman members of its empire, with exceptions. One opinion that has primarily originated in Europe, but is perhaps held all over the world, is that American presidential elections in particular should be a worldwide suffrage because of the impact of American power on the world. In the meantime, this beleaguered democracy must be reformed at home or replaced with forms of greater personal liberties that are simultaneously more civically, politically, and economically equitable, a delicate balance that is always fragile and subject to deformity. Our Constitution contains much of what is needed to repair the crushing inequity that impairs our society, but it tends to be used to protect privilege and the dominance of whoever possesses its patronage. Capitalist democracy seems to be falling apart from its own contradictions and excesses, just as Russian communism did. Democracy and capitalism were extolled as the same principle during the half-century Cold War of the 20th century. However, directly after Soviet Russia collapsed, the wealthy in America revived the ancient war against the poor and non-wealthy, which is magnified in intensity and salacious greed, represented by the collapse and public bailout of Wall Street. An accelerating disparity between the wealthy and everyone else, and the use of the law and politics to repress the deprived and dispossessed, endangers the remaining democracy and equity in this country. Economic inequality is not a natural phenomenon, but is premeditated policy, such as is first-degree murder. The bankers and financiers who caused the economic catastrophe that has plunged millions of Americans into jobless and homeless poverty have emerged incredibly more wealthy, essentially because the ordinary citizens they have pillaged have unwillingly and without consent been forced to bail them out with tax money they have lost control over. Instead of being tried as criminals, these wealthy elites purchase not only the corrupt minds and shriveled souls of elected lawmakers, but also the law itself. The only real distinction of this country is not wealth or power, but the fact that the great majority of ordinary people who do not have much wealth are the fundamental source of government power. Yet the wealthy minority dangerously beguiles themselves with the chimera that their money entitles them to authoritarian control as a corollary to wealth. The much-berated Occupy movement of a few years ago was not simply related to real estate, but of the minds and hearts of increasing millions of Americans, a revolutionary method of organizing political and cultural change in a horizontal rather than hierarchical manner. Sheila Harper of Astoria expressed it this way: "We're pushing up against real change. It is time to change our thinking from material wealth to a personal and social wealth." And as an Occupy protester said in New York City, "We are the 99%. We are the blood of this country. This country can't live without us." Our founding ancestors anticipated critical moments of great tragedy and anxiety, such as now, and realized unscrupulous persons would seize the opportunity to grasp power and dismantle our imperfect but earnest Constitution, and especially its Ten Commandments of American democracy, the Bill of Rights, which clearly and concisely spell out the rights which are also obligations of the people. The tenor of this interminable election has been more viciously ugly than perhaps since the election of Abraham Lincoln plunged the nation into civil war. It would almost seem we have the ogres and monsters of Halloween on one side, and their possible exorcism by earnestly hopeful, do-good spirits of All Saints' Day on the other. This truly is a campaign of opposites. A narcissistic, Mephistophelian, misanthrope demagogue, avatar of horror and the horrid, how else would you describe him, versus a mildly tarnished woman political marvel who in her benighted vocation is a paragon of saintliness, whose pioneering quest to be the first lady president might be the providential hope for our faltering democracy at this incredibly confused interim. Of all the wild, arrogant, and venal remarks Donald Trump has made about race, religion, and gender, and sinister threats of insurrection, the most obscene and chilling has been his gleeful boast, "I love war." That seems to have been mostly overlooked or intentionally neglected among the rest of his bombastic barrage of hateful rubbish. But it is the one to be most concerned about, because election of a president has always been choosing a wartime dictator. The most important role of the presidency is as commander-in-chief. "In time of war, it's all power to the president," a newspaper headline declared just after 9/11. On the eve of the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, imagine the possibility of a Trump presidency, a Trump War Department, and a Trump apocalypse. There are very good reasons a woman should finally be president. It is certainly a much better idea than past knee-jerk assumptions that only two white males are the only viable choices, a form of gender apartheid by a status quo unwilling to see beyond its own shriveled genitals. One excellent reason is that women generally represent the most generous and humane prospects of humanity. Women are literally pregnant with our future and provide the true compassion and Gaia wisdom of our species. For that matter, future possibilities seem limitless since Barack Obama's election as the first black president and the good chance Hillary Clinton will be America's first woman president. Perhaps a Vietnamese American, a man or woman of Iraqi, Iranian, or Afghani descent might eventually have a good shot at the presidency. Perhaps, perish the heresy, one who is Muslim American. And how about the rare possibility that our own descendants might overcome extreme prejudice and elect a multiracial transgender atheist? true justice would see a Native American elected president, perhaps one of the strong young women in the forefront of the resistance to the North Dakota pipeline that will destroy sacred lands, which has drawn universal tribal unity for the first time in living memory and has drawn sympathizers from everywhere in the United States, in contrast to the menacing alt-right militias and their cowboy fantasies. Theodore Rothke surely had this disoriented, chaotic era in mind when he wrote, "In a dark time, the eye begins to see." And that was something I wrote, "Vote for Life and Liberty." Now I'd like to read something by Bunny Dore, "Perpetual Politics," starting with a quote by Geraldine Ferraro, "All issues are women's issues." Thinking about politics, the North Coast Women's Political Caucus, of which I am a longtime member, thinks about politics all the time. Who is going to be the next county commissioner? Are there any openings on the boards and commissions of Clatsop County or the cities of Astoria, Seaside, Warrenton, Napa, Cannon Beach? The purpose of the local caucus, as of caucuses throughout the United States, is to involve women in politics, from the local school board to the White House. The caucus does not care whether they are Republicans, Democrats, or Independents, or if they are Libertarians, followers of Ross Perot, or members of a Green Party. They are not concerned with age, nationality, race, ethnic background, or marital status, except to try to reach every segment of the population. As long as they are feminist women, the caucus wants to recruit them, train them, support and elect them. Feminist women? Yes, meaning those who believe in equality for women, economic, social, political, and in women's rights to be heard. As a member of the State Steering Committee of the Oregon Women's Political Caucus, I can point out some touchstones for women and some men supported by the group. They must be pro-choice without reservations. They must believe in the worth of an equal rights amendment, and they must support measures to provide child care, even if it means government subsidies are required. In the words of Eleanor Roosevelt, women must get into the political game and stay in it. And that was Perpetual Politics by Bunny Dore. She wrote this for the North Coast Times Eagle in the summer of 1997. She died in 1998 after a long life of newspapering and political organizing. And as an epilogue, even though Iceland claims to be the primogenitory democracy on the planet, Switzerland celebrates its 725th anniversary as the world's oldest continuing republic this year, which brings to mind Graham Greene's The Third Man, which he scripted as a movie directed by Carol Reed in 1949 and later as a book. Orson Welles, as arch post-World War II black market rogue Harry Lime, excuses his criminal acts which have caused the deaths of hundreds of Viennese children with defective penicillin, tells his naive American friend Holly Martins, a pulp Western writer, played by Joseph Cotton, in the manner of a Donald Trump, that Italy in the 15th century was a turmoil of warfare, murder, terror, and bloodshed, yet produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance, whereas Switzerland, which has enjoyed five centuries of peace, democracy, and brotherly love, has produced only the cuckoo clock. After 240 years of Yankee Doodle democracy, the United States has produced a cockamamie clocker cuckoo. This has been Michael McCusker. Vote. It's your only real Second Amendment protection, the revolutionary musket in the closet.